40 years ago, a number of Episcopalians were very concerned about doctrine in the church. And as a result of that, in 1977, they met and made a decision. That decision has affected us who are part of the continuum since. We have had our struggles as members of the continuum over these 40 years, but thanks be to God, only recently, in the past 3 months, some progress has been made in bringing divided jurisdictions together. That's such a positive move, and we hope that in the future we will get to be one. 40 years ago, one of our panelists here was present at that signing of the Declaration of the Affirmation of St. Louis. We here need to know more about what happened. We need to know what have been the successes and the failures, and we who are here need to in turn tell others who are not aware of these, of who we are. And it's not surprising that many people today, even seminarians in the Episcopal Church, do not have a clue as to who they are and who we are. Only recently we had a priest and a theological student attending All Angels who thought that we were all on the same road as members of the church. And when we explained to them, they were like shocked. Not knowing. Yes, we call ourselves Anglicans, but there are a few differences. And there's no one more qualified to share with us what took place in 1977, then Reverend Dr. Canon Kenneth Gunn-Wahlberg. Canon Gunn-Wahlberg is a Canadian who has lived here for many years. He had his early education in Winnipeg Public Schools. He had read for his BA in 1965 at the United College in University of Manitoba in English, Economics and History. He did his MA in 1967 from that same university in American, French, Canadian, British, and European Studies, and his PhD in 1971 from the University of Guelph, 19th and early 20th century American, Canadian, British, and European History. He has several certificates and awards. And one of his major awards was the best history essay by a history graduate or undergraduate student of the University of Manitoba in 1967. He did this on Lenin, the mind of a compulsive revolutionary, Ontario Graduate Fellowships in 1967-70. His doctoral thesis was the Church Union Movement in Manitoba, 1902 to 1925, a cultural study in the decline of denominationalism within the Protestant ascendancy. Is that the correct pronunciation? Ascendancy. The Canon Gunn-Wahlberg has served the ACC for many years, and is very highly respected among members of the clergy, not only of the ACC, but of the continuum.
Enough.
He says, that's enough. I could go on and go on. But Canon is my, not only my colleague in ministry, but my friend. I tell everybody, only when I'm in his presence that I laugh so much, because he has such a marvelous sense of humor. Marvelous sense of humor, and I enjoy being with him. So without further ado, I want to present to you Reverend Canon Dr. Reverend Dr. Canon Kenneth Dunbar. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, as mentioned, my topic today is the 40th anniversary of the Congress of St. Louis, original intent, successes, and failures. And I thought our first hymn today, sort of joyous, brilliant, triumphal, and then we had the first lesson, which was rather warlike. And so that is the history in short. Good intention, bad results. But the St. Louis Congress convened at the Park Plaza Hotel in St. Louis from the 14th to the 16th of September in 1977. There were 1,746 registered. And so on its 40th anniversary, we gather here today to reflect upon the events preceding that event, its intent, its successes, its failures over the last 40 odd years, with some emphasis upon the odd. Well, first of all, what led to the Congress? Well, it was that traditional and orthodox within the Episcopal Church responded to what was occurring in that church, both in the United States and then also the Anglican Church of Canada. Many of the same things were happening. And what we find is that beginning with the mid 1950s and increasing into the 70s, and indeed continuing today, are what? Well, there is a certain trendiness, radicalism, theological liberalism, and liturgical deformation infecting the two national churches. And the resistance came from within the church itself, or both churches, not from outside, of course, because there weren't that many continuing Anglicans at the time. And what there were very small groups with rather dubious antecedents. And so we had that resistance to experimentation and a wanting to have the retention of Anglican Orthodoxy. And it's very important to stress that they did not want to be schismatics. They wanted to be continuing Anglicans, keeping the best of the faith. However, below the surface, although they sought unity, they were rather disunited from the beginning. And there were tensions from the onset. And there were those who wanted to gain personal advantage, prestige, but most of the so-called continuers were in their motivations rather pure. However, here's the rub, that we had the high church folk who looked to the earliest period of Anglicanism, to the Caroline Divines, and the late Oxford movement for their inspiration, both in terms of ritual, doctrine, and tradition with a capital T. We also had Anglo-Catholics who were very much influenced by Roman ritual and Tractarianism. And then we had the low church element were basically Protestant, stressing doctrine grounded in biblical sufficiency, a rather symbolic comprehension of the communion rites, and certain skepticism regarding what authority, what power bishops should have. And then we had the so-called broad church, which tended to be rather hazy and lazy and wanted everyone to get along, but they basically sort of sided with the low church group but were permissive of Anglo-Catholics or high churchmen. But they were rather hostile, especially, however, to Anglo-Catholics. And basically, Anglo-Catholics could be Anglo-Catholics in their own parishes, but don't try to bring your pretensions into our churches. So that was a problem. And in terms of the continuing church movement, there are two books I would recommend. We have Divided We Stand. And just out of curiosity, who has read Divided We Stand? Wallace Spalding has read Divided We Stand. Okay. And this was written in 2002. And the latest book is The Day Spring From On High by the Reverend Paul C. Hewitt. Anyone read this one? All 850 pages?
I haven't read it yet, but I have.
You have it, and you're using it as a doorstop right now.
Okay.
It's rather idiosyncratic. He sort of starts off with being a British Israelite and how Jesus visited England and approved. And then also we have a paper that was given by Wally to the Fellowship of Concerned Churchmen in September 2009, which is very helpful and very much recommended. So there's your reading list for today. However, let's go back to the church. When the conference, well, there had been a major problem. The PCUSA, or NUCUSA, had been acting to prevent secession in Colorado and California. Meanwhile, the ECM had favored the new prayer book. It was an evangelical Catholic movement, but it wasn't moving very well, and it was neither really evangelical or Catholic, but it did have that split. And because they favored the new prayer book, Father Robert C. Harvey called them collaborationist rather than loyalist. And the successor to the ECM today is the ACNA, and Wally will probably be saying a few words about it later on, because it has priestesses, parts of it, other parts don't, etc., etc., similar to the ECM, which was around at the commencement. Also, the organization that Wally presently heads, the FCC, was the primary promoter of the St. Louis conference. And interestingly, two bishops who had been consecrated, were Bishop Dees, a Southern racialist, and Bishop Clavier, who had a very thick resume, but no curriculum vitae. And we did have three PCUSA bishops, or ACUSA, who did take part in the Congress, Bishop Chambers, Bishop Boynton, and Hayden, the latter, the only bishop who was active, who took place. What we had at the conference itself was the word Catholic being used by many speakers, but there was a significant difference in meaning when used by such as Father Carol Simcox, who was one of the principal people there and wrote a lot. And Father George Rutler, who later was to go to Rome, who also was a very elegant writer. So we have Protestant and Catholic divisions immediately. On the second day of the Congress, Bishop Chambers was the celebrant at the sung Eucharist, and later in the day the speakers included Canada's own Father Camino de Catanzaro, Father George H. Clendenin, and who was at the our synod, our provincial synod? Because he spoke, and he did an excellent job. And also speaking were Dorothy Faber from Christian Challenge, Father James O. Moat, who was elected first bishop of the movement, and quite suitable as he was the first priest to have withdrawn from DeCusa after the 1976 General Convention. So that was pretty much what occurred at the conference. I was not present. I was in Winnipeg writing some papers. I did a paper in Uppsala later that summer, and also the Banff Conference on Central and Eastern Studies. However, I was convener of the first synod of the Anglican Catholic Church of Canada. It was held in Winnipeg 21st to 22nd September 1979. We elected Father De Catanzaro, Dr. De Catanzaro, as our first bishop, and he then sent me to Holy Rood Seminary a couple of years later, and more of that on. Well, there was a statement issued by the Congress of St. Louis. That was the affirmation of St. Louis, and the proposed name of the new body was the Anglican Church in North America, and now we have another Anglican Church in North America, which is nothing like the original church, but as Wally has indicated, those who were entering the body to put together the affirmation came in as the Anglican Church in North America. They left the room as the Anglican Catholic Church, and how that came about, I don't know, but maybe Wally can tell us later what happened in that room. I think that perhaps that was not the wisest decision, but because it was purely wearing an Anglo-Catholic banner, and that was not attractive to a lot of prayer book folk. This formalized the schism in the in DeCusa, and in 1977 the DeCusa schism was noted as the top religious story of the year by the Religious News Writers Association. There were other stories vying for that same appellation, including Archbishop Lefebvre, who had split from the RC Church. The Moody's were quite active at that time, and also the evangelical born again movement. Well, we beat them out, or at least a schism beat them out. And so that was sort of the high water point of the history of the continuing church movement. However, it is true that the attendees at St. Louis were full of confidence. They had magnificent hopes for the future. However, there was a problem in the affirmation of St. Louis itself. And what was that? Well, it certainly bore testimony to problems that were to come. So let us look at the earliest obfuscations that led to future rancor and ecclesiastical splits that Dr. Spalding has chronicled over the last 40 years. Well, number one, the Eucharist. The Holy Eucharist was described as a sacrifice, and in the same sentence, it was described as his body and blood. and also asserting the all-sufficient sacrifice of Christ on the cross. And this was generally used by Protestants, of course, to counter the Catholic belief of the sacrificial nature of the Eucharist. So, doublespeak. And then number two, the sacraments were listed as seven, placating the more Catholic-minded. But then the, quote, necessity of baptism and confirmation, as contained in the prayer book catechism, was listed. So we had two necessary sacraments. We had seven unnecessary sacraments, five unnecessary sacraments. Not sure. But anyway, seven was mentioned, two were mentioned. Number three, the acceptable standard for doctrine was to be the tradition of the Church. Tradition with a capital T. And, quote, to the exclusion of all errors, ancient and modern. Well, what were the ancient errors? Was the reference to early heresies? That's what most Catholics, whether they were broad or high or really spiky, would read it as. Or was it for those sections of the Council's renderings on the ever-virginity of Mary or the real presence in the Eucharist? So you again had to pick and choose. Ancient errors that had been discussed at the Council, condemned, or actually things that were discussed at any of the seven ecumenical councils, and then accepted, which included the ever-virginity of Mary and the real presence in the Eucharist, which Protestants would regard as heretical and non-biblical, and as one of the errors, or two of the errors, of the council themselves. Also, the question was what Episcopal Church was going to be continued. That of the prayer book in a parish perhaps in Little Rock or a missal parish in New York City? And would coexistence be possible? Well, the answer in short order would be a resounding no. And that is sort of the beginning of the splits. Well, then we had the problem of forming dioceses. We had the formation of provincial dioceses, but they were based on non-geographic boundaries. So right at the beginning, we had two bishops fighting over the same people. You could join either bishop. And the result was that any parish in the United States could join the Diocese of the Holy Trinity another of the Diocese of Christ the King under Robert Morse. Then, although that problem was not solved, there was another problem. That then we formed two more or less geographic dioceses, which then you had no choice, unless you wanted to go one of the first two dioceses. But these were geographic dioceses, and they were the Diocese of the Midwest and the Diocese of the Southeast. On January 1978 came into being our own diocese, which was a geographic diocese of the Mid-Atlantic states. And so we have that great moment then, and that is the Denver consecrations. Well, we managed to get Bishops Chambers and Bishop Tactican. Now, Tactican came from the Philippine Independent Church, which was sort of part of the Anglican Communion. And these two were the only two that were present physically. However, Father Dorn had brought a letter from Bishop Hay of Korea giving his consent, but without his physical presence. And so the Denver consecrations were questioned as to their validity. Well, at least there are questions about some as to their validity. And also, the Denver consecrations were regarded as the concluding moment of the St. Louis Congress. Why is that? Well, it was the last time the continuing church issuing from the Congress was to be jurisdictionally one. And the story, which perhaps Dr. Spalding will be so kind to relate to us, would require a great diagram, which is beyond my viewpoint desire. But the continuing story would be simply too complex to be sorted out in a brief paper. Why is that? Well, let's look at what the situation was at the time. We started out with two bishops and four bishops, now five bishops. But over the years, they were too proliferate. And so this is the part I'm going to leave out and have these various splits described to you. But they included the Anglican Catholic Church, ACC, that's us, the Anglican Church of Canada, that came a bit later, the AEC, the American Episcopal Church, the AOC, the Anglican Orthodox Church, AMIA, the Anglican Mission in America, APA, the Anglican Province in America, APCK, the Anglican Province of Christ the King, ARJA, Anglican Rite Jurisdiction in the Americas, the CEC, the Charismatic Episcopal Church, the EHC, the Episcopal Missionary, or EMC, the Episcopal Missionary Church. Later on, we had the ACC-AR, the Holy Catholic Church, Anglican Rite. We had the SEC, the Southern Episcopal Church, the TPEC, Traditional Protestant Episcopal Church, the UAC, the United Anglican Church, the UEC, the United Episcopal Church, UECA, the United Episcopal Church America, and our present partner, the APA, the Anglican Province of America, the ACA, the Anglican Church in America, and the DHC, the Diocese of the Holy Cross, which was a split from another diocese. So, as Archbishop Haviland wrote recently, perhaps we should say that while we have done our very best as to messing up the continuing church, God has given us a second chance. We have the opportunity to get things right this time. And of course, he refers to our recent meeting in Atlanta. You may have read the recent Trinitarian. I think it was two issues ago. Joint Synod's a Giant Step, and the accompanying sidebar read, the four churches have a combined total of 215 parishes in the United States, and they've grown increasingly close in recent years. Well, perhaps this is true, perhaps there is a golden hope for our future. What if we say that quite generously, there are 40 people in each of those parishes. Well, it adds up to 8,600 people. Not a quite, it may be a town, it may be a village, but it encompasses the entire United States. And at the time of the Congress of St. Louis, the estimates were we're going to have about a million or so Anglicans by the 40th anniversary. Well, that hasn't quite worked out. That prediction was somewhat false, or at least mistaken. And the problem remains, however, that our new partners each bring in a bit of a troubled past themselves. And I don't know if this is true or not, but we did not have the oldest group associated with us, the Province of Christ the King. Well, why not? Some said it was a result of their recent trouble with Bishop Provence, adulterous Bishop Provence. Others have, and they're healing their wounds right now. Well, maybe they're healing their wounds, maybe they aren't, because there's another rumor that, no, they were rather troubled about the APA. Yes? Oh, nothing requiring a prayer? Okay, so we had that problem, and we also have problems ourselves. We know that we have problems within the diocese, and so perhaps it will assist, however, in jurisdiction hopping. Hopefully the bishops will communicate, and we will not have priests weeping out from one the church to another whenever they become disgruntled. And also, however, we're left with the problem of overlapping jurisdictions. And most of the bishops present, I don't know if you saw the picture of the Trinitarian, I counted 20 bishops, but at the synod itself, I counted 25 bishops. That's a lot of bishops for maybe 8,100 or 8,600 people. And how are we going to resolve this problem of jurisdictional overlaps? Because all the bishops seem to be in reasonably good health. They seem they're going to be around for a while. How are they going to solve their, not only the differences, but the problem of overlapping jurisdictions? We don't know. And so that is basically where we are today, at least from my perspective. But then we have the new Anglican Church in North America. And it claims to have 100,000 communicants, 280 dioceses, is that correct? 280 dioceses.
Churches.
280 churches, perhaps, and about, no, it claims 700 parishes, according to your last newsletter. So anyway, there are problems, a bit of our problem in our own diocese, as I mentioned, and there are significant issues to be resolved with the agreement that we reach in Atlanta over the next decade. And so an old curse may live in interesting times. Well, indeed, we do live in interesting times. Thank you.